Over the years, we've seen incidents and cases that logic and science can't explain. It was nothing new to us, stuff Lorraine and I were used to. But nothing could have prepared us for the house on Chase Street. When we first got to the Smurl family's home in West Pittsens, Pennsylvania, the summer sun felt heavy, but the house looked dark, like it swallowed the light. The porch steps groaned like bones breaking. The paint was peeling, and the windows were covered in a greasy film. Even the grass around the house was dead, like the ground itself was poisoned. Lorraine grabbed my arm so tight it hurt. Her face turned white.
"Ed,"
she whispered.
"It's everywhere here."
The smell hit me next. Rotten meat and burnt hair, but weirdly sweet, like old candy. Inside, the walls seemed to move, like they were breathing. Jack and Janet Smurl stood in the hallway, their eyes hollow, hands shaking. Their four girls hid behind them, too scared to speak. Upstairs, Jack's parents barely left their room.
"It gets worse when it's dark,"
Janet said, her voice cracking.
"It touches us."
Jack rolled up his sleeve to show bruises shaped like long fingers. "It grabbed my ankle and dragged me off the bed," he said.
"Left these marks."
Janet lifted her shirt. Four deep cuts ran down her back, the skin black and wet.
"They won't heal. They just leak."
The kids' stories were worse. The youngest, Heather, woke up screaming about a man with no face who pinched their toes. Twins Mary and Laura drew pictures of a shadow that licked the windows, leaving greasy streaks. The oldest, Susan, said her closet door would creak open at night, and she'd hear something scratching the floor, getting closer to her bed. That night, we set up cameras and tape recorders. Lorraine sat on the floor, holding her cross, her eyes closed like she was listening for something. Midnight came. The house got too quiet. Then, a growl. Not a dog, not a person. Something deeper, meaner. The room turned freezing cold. Our breath turned to fog. The growl became a crash. Walls shaking, doors slamming. Something heavy ran down the hall towards us. Thud, thud, thud. Each step makes the floorboards crack. Above us, the ceiling creaked like something was crawling up there, claws scratching the plaster. Then, a scream. Jack's mom. We ran upstairs. Her door shook like something was trying to break out. When it flew open, the room stank like rotting meat. The old woman pointed to the corner, shaking. There, in the dark, a shape formed from the shadows. Tall, black as oil, with glowing yellow eyes. The air around it twisted, like heat off a fire. Lorraine jumped in front of me as it lunged. Then, it broke apart into flies that dropped dead on the floor. The next few days were hell. Jack got thrown into a dresser by nothing, his ribs cracking. Janet's hair got yanked so hard her neck snapped back, and she felt hot breath on her ear growled.
"Mine."
The kids' toys moved by themselves. Dolls with melted faces crawled up the stairs, and a rocking horse smashed itself to pieces. One night, the kitchen faucet turned on by itself, spewing black water that smelled like sewage. The thing got stronger. Lorraine saw it crawl on the ceiling like a spider, legs bending wrong. Black mold spread on the walls, making evil markings, upside-down crosses, symbols like goat heads. Mirrors exploded, glass shards making patterns that hurt to look at. The walls leaked black slime that burned skin and made the kids puke. One night, Lorraine told me what she felt during her trance.
"It's not just one ghost, Ed. It's hundreds, trapped here, turning into something hungry."
She shook, describing a pit full of screaming people, all stuck together, rotting. We called Father Dylan, an old priest who'd done exorcisms before. He walked in and froze.
"This place stinks of hell,"
he said. We started the exorcism at noon. The priest shouted prayers, but the house fought back. Floorboards shot nails up like spikes. The Bible caught fire. A chandelier fell, almost hitting him. He kept going, splashing holy water that hissed on the walls. Then, silence. For a second, we thought we won. The laughs started low, like a sick joke. The walls bulged, shapes pressing against them, hands, faces, all trying to break through. Father Dylan's nose bled.
"It's not leaving!"
he yelled. Then, a cut opened on his cheek like a knife slashed him. That night, the thing went wild. Jack woke up, unable to move, something crushing his chest. Janet floated off her bed, her back bending until it snapped before she dropped to the floor. In the girls' room, Heather's teddy bear exploded, spitting out maggots that crawled into their ears. The whole time, a voice boomed, a mix of screams and growls.
Flesh to break, bones to drink.
We ran at sunrise, the Smurls piling into our car with nothing but their clothes, but the darkness followed. In their new apartment, sinks spat black goo. Family photos burst into flames. Heather's reflection in the mirror moved on its own, mouthing words that made her stop talking for weeks. One night, Jack's dad woke up to find his pillow soaked in blood, though he had no wounds. The TV would turn on by itself, showing static with glowing eyes in the center. It took 3 years of prayers, charms, and sleepless nights for the hauntings to fade. The Smurls moved again and changed their phone numbers, but they still jumped at every noise. The house on Chase Street is still there. New owners painted it yellow, but no one lived there long. Neighbors hear things, kids laughing, then screaming. A low growl in the dark saying,
"More!"
Sometimes at midnight, the streetlights flicker out, and the house seems to grow taller, leaning over the sidewalk like it's watching. Not all hauntings can be cleansed, not all demons can be cast out. Some just wait in the dark, getting hungrier. In the 1970s and 80s, the Smurl family experienced one of the most violent hauntings ever documented. After moving into their home, they were tormented by a demonic entity. The activity included foul odors and dark shadows creeping along the walls, loud banging and growling sounds at night, family members being levitated and scratched, a dark shadowy figure dragging one family member across the bed. The Smurls sought help from Ed and Lorraine Warren, who confirmed demonic activity. Exorcisms were performed, but the family eventually moved to escape the horror. I never thought ghosts existed, or curses, or any of the spooky tales told at bedtime to keep children out of abandoned houses. But all that changed when I became an employee at the Kansas State History Museum. It wasn't anything out of the ordinary at first. I was just a night security guard, the new guy. The work was easy. Patrol the halls, keep an eye out for anyone who tried to steal any of the artifacts, and don't fall asleep. But there was one exhibit that creeped me out, even in the daylight. The Bender family exhibit. It was the old senior guard, Hank, who had told me the tale. He was a gruff old fellow, a lifer in the museum trade, and he had that kind of voice that made each tale sound 1,000 times more terrible than it was.
"You ever hear of the Bloody Benders?"
he asked one evening, leaning on his flashlight. I nodded my head.
"Well, back in the 1870s, a family, father, mother, son, daughter, ran an inn out in the middle of nowhere. Travelers would stop by for a meal, maybe a night's rest, but they never left. The Benders had a trick, a curtain in their cabin that separated the dining area from the back. When they had a guest sit with his back to it, one of the men would strike his skull with a hammer, and the women would cut his throat. They'd then toss the body in a pit in the back. No one had any idea how many they murdered before people began suspecting something."
I gulped. "And they got caught?" Hank laughed, shaking his head.
"Nope. They disappeared before the law arrived knocking. Some claimed they ran. Others claimed the townspeople killed them and silenced it. But their cabin? They torched it to the ground, claimed the ground was cursed."
I giggled uneasily. So why does the museum have anything from it? Hank's face turned black.
Few of the artifacts were recovered. Some tools, some furnishings, and that mirror.
He gestured across the room. An old broken mirror on the wall had a darkened, aged surface.
People say they see faces in it, shadows. Sometimes people hear screams at night late.
I brushed him off. Ah, museum legends. All places like these have them. He only smirked.
Have a good night, kid.
I didn't pay much attention to it until I was by myself. The museum was still, too still. Each step creaked. Each little groan made me shiver. I made my rounds, passing by glass cases of rusty tools and bloodied knives. The mirror was the worst. Each time I walked by, I could have sworn something was just out of sight, waiting. At 2 a.m., the first sound was heard, a muffled scream. I was immobile. My radio spat static to life, hissing before it cut off. The sound returned, low, panicked, as if a person were wedged in between the walls. Hello? My voice trembled barely. No reply, just emptiness. And then, footsteps. Bare feet on the museum floor. I spun around. Nothing. But the atmosphere clung heavy and thick and crushing. The cold hit like ice, my breath misting in the shadows. The mirror. I spun around. My face was there, but something was off. My breath caught. There was someone standing behind me. A woman. Her face was white, eyes empty, blood trickling from a cut across her throat. She stretched out, fingers quivering, her lips moving as if she was attempting to say something. Then, she attacked. I stumbled backward, heart pounding. But when I spun around, no one was there. Just nothing. I ran. Forget the job. Forget everything. I bolted for the door, but it wouldn't open. The security system had sealed them for the night. I grabbed my radio, but all I got was static. Behind me, the artifacts clattered in their cases. The tools rolled. The knives skidded across the glass. Then, the whispering began. Whispering at first. Then shouting. Dozens of voices. Screaming. Wailing. Begging. The mirror broke. The blow knocked me to the ground. My palms scraping the frigid floor. The air grew rank. The reek of decaying flesh filling my nostrils. A form crept out of the shadows. Skull white. Jagged. Its head hanging to one side unnaturally. Black pits for eyes, its mouth stretching wide enough to cleave its face in two, a hammer held in one bony fist. The walls began to bleed. Black, viscous liquid oozed out of the cracks, forming a puddle at my feet. Something moved in the darkness, a twisted, deformed figure with its limbs twisting in directions that shouldn't. It crawled towards me, speaking in voices that don't belong to this world. A woman's rotting hand burst forth from the floor, grasping at my ankle. Icy fingers closed around my skin, tugging me down. I screamed, thrashing about, but the hold only grew stronger. More hands burst forth from the ground, bony fingers grasping at my skin, pulling me further into the depths. The overhead lighting flashed wildly. The wall shadows crept and distorted, becoming long, skinny figures with empty eyes and twisted, grinning mouths. The laughter began, deep and rasping at first, then swelling into a frenzy of shrieking, demented cackles. My reflection in the broken mirror started to stir. It smiled, advancing, its eyes brimming with black emptiness. It extended a hand, pushing a palm against the glass. And then, passing through as if the wall between worlds had disappeared. I struggled, fighting against the cold clutch of the hands. The last thing I remember was seeing my own face looming over me, speaking words I couldn't hear. Then, blackness consumed me. I awoke in the morning. The museum was fine. No shattered mirror and no artifacts spilled across the floor. Just Hank, looming over me, shaking his head.
Looks like you had yourself a rough night.
I sat up, my body throbbing.
You didn't see anything?
Hank just grinned, but his eyes were different. Something told.
Guess you believe the stories now.
I left that day, never went back. But every so often in the middle of the night, I still hear them, the screams. And I know whatever is haunting that place, it's still waiting. The Bloody Benders were a family of serial killers who lured travelers to their Kansas cabin in the 1870s, murdered them, and buried their bodies in the yard. After the Benders vanished to escape justice, locals reported horrifying paranormal activity in the abandoned house. Muffled screams and cries for help, apparitions of the victims wandering the land, furniture moving on its own, and unseen forces pushing visitors. Horses refusing to go near the property. The house was eventually burned down due to fear, but the land remains infamous for eerie encounters. I never thought my past would come back to haunt me like this. Not here, not now, not with his face grinning from every headline, those dead fish eyes staring through the screen as if they could still dissect me. It started like any other monotonous day at work, if you could call the suffocating heat of the bakery's ovens and the reek of burnt sugar.
Monotony.
The industrial fans groaned like dying animals, their blades slicing through air thick with the cloying sweetness of caramelizing dough. My apron clung to me, damp with sweat and flour, as I loaded tray after tray into the oven's glowing jaws. Timothy Bass drifted through the haze like smoke, always watching, never blinking. His boots squeaked against the linoleum in a rhythm that matched the pulse throbbing in my throat. He'd materialize behind the women, always the women, his breath a wet rasp against their necks as he
reached for a muffin
or
adjusted the thermostat.
Once I caught him sniffing the chair where Janine had been sitting, his nostrils flaring like a hound's, fingertips digging into the vinyl until it crackled. When I froze, a tray trembling in my hands, he turned slowly, smiled. His teeth were too white, too straight, as if they'd been filed to points.
"Something wrong?"
he asked, tilting his head like a curious predator. The scar on his left cheek thin, surgical, a pale worm buried under stubble, twitched as he spoke. I shook my head, my tongue glued to the roof of my mouth, but I knew. I knew the way prey knows the shadow circling overhead isn't just a cloud. It wasn't until years later, scrolling through cold case files at 3 a.m. while my husband snored oblivious beside me, that I saw her name again. The screen's blue light carved hollows into the dark, and there she was, Mandy, her senior photo glowing like a ghost. Acme, Washington, 1989. A girl so vibrantly alive she seemed to burn through the pixelated image. Wild auburn curls, freckles like scattered cinnamon, eyes the fierce green of summer leaves before they rot. A track star, a fighter, the kind of girl who'd laugh as she outran the boys, her German Shepherd Duke loping at her heels like a tawny shadow, until November 24th. She had gone for a jog with her German Shepherd, a routine run, something she had done 100 times before. But on that fateful November day, she didn't come home. Her dog returned alone, its fur damp, its eyes wild. Something was wrong. Something unholy had taken root in the small town, and its name had no face. Not yet. 3 days later, two fishermen found Mandy. The Nooksack River had peeled her to horror, its icy fingers probing every wound, every violation. Her skin was the color of a week-old bruise, lips parted in a silent scream, hair tangled with twigs and riverweed like a crown of thorns. They'd pulled her onto the bank and one of the men vomited into the shallows. Bruises bloomed across her legs in the shape of grasping hands. Crescent moon cuts scored her palms. From her own nails, the coroner would say, as she clawed at her attacker's face. But the worst was her eyes. Wide open, clouded, hungry, as if death hadn't stopped her from searching for the monster who'd done this. The town unraveled. Porch lights burned through the night. Fathers cleaned shotguns at kitchen tables. Mothers checked closets before bed. Reverend Cole preached about the devil walking among them, his spit flecking the pulpit as he snarled.
"Look to your neighbors!"
For weeks, the only footprints in the autumn mud belonged to detectives and grieving parents. Then the snow came, burying leads, burying hope, burying Mandy in a polished casket too small for her laughter. The case froze, buried, forgotten. Until 2017, until Detective Bohe, all nicotine and caffeine and rage, thawed it with a DNA test. Until I sat in a too-cold interrogation room, my breath fogging the two-way mirror, and whispered,
"Timothy Bass."
I told them everything. How he'd linger by the time cards, memorizing schedules. How he'd hum Sweet Child of Mine while scrubbing blood, chicken blood, he claimed, from the meat slicer. Once, after Mandy's face flashed on the break room TV, he'd sighed.
"Pretty thing. Bet she was wild up to the end."
His tongue darted out, lizard quick, catching a drop of coffee on his lip. The cops found the soda can in his garbage, buried under a rat's nest of Hustler magazines and frayed ropes. A Pepsi from 1989, its logo faded, dented as if kicked in a rage. They told me the DNA was a
statistical miracle.
Saliva on the rim, skin cells in the grooves, a map of guilt etched in double helixes. The trial was a circus of horrors. Timothy's lawyer painted Mandy as a free-spirited teen who'd explored the woods with a secret lover. The gallery erupted. Mr. Stavik lunged, howling, until bailiffs dragged him out. Timothy just smiled, fingers steepled, watching me from the bench. I felt those fingers on my throat, in my hair, snap. When the prosecutor displayed the Coke bottle, the one found near Mandy's body, its glass smeared with Timothy's sweat, I gagged. The courtroom tilted. For a heartbeat, I was in those woods, the air thick with the stench of crushed ferns and copper, her screams clotting in my lungs. The jury deliberated for 8 hours, when the foreman spat,
"Guilty."
Timothy finally moved. He leaned toward me, cuffs clinking, and mouthed,
"You're next."
They gave him 27 years. 27 years for stealing a lifetime, for turning a river into a tomb. The judge called it closure, but closure is a myth sold to the grieving. There's no coffin heavy enough to crush the what-ifs. Now I dream of her, not the Mandy in the photos, but the other Mandy, the one the river made. Her skin sloughs off in translucent ribbons, lips nibbled by crawdads, eye sockets teeming with leeches. She runs, but her legs buckle, tendons snapping like rotten rubber bands. The woods creak and moan, branches knitting into a cage. Behind her, footsteps, heavy, relentless, a whistle, Sweet Child of Mine, off-key and dripping malice.
"God help me!"
She gurgles, river water geysering from her throat.
"Why didn't you help me?"
I wake screaming, my sheets soaked in November rain. My husband murmurs,
"Nightmare?"
and rolls over. He doesn't understand. They never do. In 1989, 18-year-old Mandy Stavik disappeared while jogging near her home in Acme, Washington. Her body was found in the Nooksack River 3 days later. Despite an extensive investigation, the case went cold for nearly 30 years. In 2017, detectives used forensic genealogy to identify Timothy Bass, a former neighbor, as a suspect. DNA recovered from Bass's discarded Coke can matched evidence from the crime scene. He was arrested and convicted of murder, receiving nearly 27 years in prison. The case was groundbreaking for its use of genetic genealogy in solving decades-old crimes.